Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. It once again I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, sponsored by the National Association of Adult Survivors for Child Abuse. Tonight we have our show that we call our For Our Kids show, and this is because every 2 weeks on a Thursday night, there's a special group of NASCA family members who are from both Canada and the United States who have banded together, and they'll bring us different kinds of stories and issues that are happening on both sides of our borders. What we'll recognize as the time goes on, this is their sixth time doing a show, and what we are recognizing already and will continue to recognize is that the issues on both sides of the borders may be dealt with by agencies that have slightly different names, but the issues themselves are basically the same issues. So we're going to find that out more and more, I think, as we go through, at least that's what I expect. And that's the theme of tonight's show, the issues for families and children on both sides of the border and their rights. In order to do tonight's show, we have a panel of people who are going to be here, and they are headed up by Deborah Madison. Deborah Madison is from British Columbia, and she is the guest host of tonight's show, and I'll be there with her to co-host it and push the buttons for her. But let me first bring Deborah to the air and welcome her to the show. Deborah Madison from British Columbia. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Bill. Thank you very much for bringing us on again. We're always happy to be here.
You're welcome. And as part of the group here, we're going to also include Tracy, who's there in British Columbia. We're also going to include we don't know about Angela. Yeah, okay, say hi. Say hi, Tracy. Go ahead.
Hi, everybody. This is Tracy. Looking forward to tonight's show.
Right. And we have Angela Bortz, and she can say hi. Angela?
Awesome. Am I here? I'm here.
Yes, just say hi. Just to say hi. Okay. And welcome to the show, Angela, and thank you for coming back. And then we have a number of people who are new to us, but also some panelists from the regular show. And I want to get everybody introduced so that we can get this behind us, because this is a little bit of a job on a night when we have so many phone numbers. The next person I'm going to introduce is Thomas Stone, who's a regular panelist with NASCA. He calls from Alberta, Canada, so he's a fellow Canadian. Thomas, thanks for being here tonight.
My pleasure.
Okay, good. Next up, I noticed that we're expecting a couple other people. One of them, Kevin Klein, who is here, and let me say it, Kevin, and he's from Tacoma, Washington area. Kevin, hello to you, and thank you for being here.
My pleasure as well.
Okay. And finally, the last person that's called in is Alea Holland, and she is an author and a filmmaker, I guess. Where are you from, Alea? You better tell me. I don't remember. Where are you from, Alea?
I'm from Brooklyn, New York.
Brooklyn,
can you hear me?
I know Brooklyn very well. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm from the New York City area. Oh, Brooklyn is awesome. Mine is family court, corruption, and CPS and ACS, but they're awesome.
All right, we'll get into that a little later in the show. But Alea Holland, I didn't expect the New York City accent, but she's from Brooklyn, New York. Yay! My mother's from Park Slope. I lived in the Heights for a while, Brooklyn Heights, before I came to California. So anyway, I know Brooklyn very well. And okay, so Deborah, I'm going to bring you back on, and I want to say at the top of the show that we're going to check in with a guest who was with us last time, 2 weeks ago, and by way of just finding out, what's happened in the interim, we're going to check in with her, and that's, of course, Jane Wells. But before we get to her, I want to make sure that everybody understands that, because it came up last week, and it came up, in such a way that it's important for me to explain that NASCA, of course, Deborah, is very grateful to you and the other ladies there and the other men and ladies there who are bringing these issues to us so we can understand what the issues are of sort of human rights and the rights of children and families and so forth. But when we talk about individual cases, we don't choose a side for a case. We can't. That's not our job. So just by way of saying that bluntly, we don't take sides. We don't know who's right and who's wrong, and we don't pretend we know. But we do present the issues, and the issues are important for us to know because they're things that occur over and over. And I might ask you to comment on this theme before we get to the bulk of the show, Deborah.
Yes, I would actually just like to say that there's a reason we don't take sides, because the issues are systemic. There's no one person that causes mm-hmm. this problem. And so we mm-hmm. can bring people that may be caught in a terrible situation, and maybe there's good and bad people on both sides of this situation, but that's what we really do mean by not taking sides, because there are good government workers, there's bad government workers, there's good parents, there's bad parents. You know, the world is not that polarized. So we try to, unfortunately we have to highlight unpleasant issues, but that doesn't mean everybody, there's one person to blame in any one issue. It takes a whole system to contribute
That's
to
right.
this situation. So,
That's right.
Yes, I do feel it's very important. And also, it's not even geographical specific. It's so widespread that you simply can't point a finger at any one thing or person. It's too systemic.
Right. And it's a pandemic, and it's a worldwide pandemic, and we're usually going to be talking about North America, but you could again apply this to other parts of the world too. And this behavior that we're talking about is repeated over and over and over again. So it's the issues that were important to us, and obviously we don't give out legal advice or anything like that either, because we're not lawyers. So, all right. But anyway, now that we've covered that, and I'm glad we did, why don't you tell us who's going to come on first, Jane, namely Jane, and what we're going to hear from her.
Hey, well, we were going to, we did hear the background story from Jane Wells last week, and we did not quite have time to just sort of update her ongoing current situation, which is it's actually a little bit more relevant to what we cover, but we felt her background was so important as to how they were systemically and intergenerationally targeted that we introduced that last show. And if people recall her children and her, they saw their father murdered in front of them, and it caused a lot of issues for her and her children, and they did not get the supports they needed. And now it's brought them to where they are now, and we would like her to just update to what's happening with her and her daughter and grandchildren now in the present day, because we covered what led up to this in the last show, if that's okay. And then this is mostly a U.S. show this week, so I would really like to get insight from Alea and Kevin on the issues that Jane is discussing on this, if that is okay.
Of course, we can do that. So, in other words, we covered Jane's story really fully last time, which is 2 weeks ago. So if you want to hear the whole story, obviously it's there, it exists, and you can go back and listen to the whole story. But we want to make sure that we gave an opportunity for her to come in tonight and update us with what's gone on in the interim. So let me bring her on. Jane Wells, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So from the infants, well.
I'm sorry? Can you give us an idea of what's happened since you last spoke to us 2 weeks ago?
Nothing's happened for 2 weeks. I don't have an attorney, and I can't.
Okay.
Basically, the situation with your daughter, Jane, and how to sort of outline it a bit and get Jane to bring in the details is that her daughter had some issues, you know, with her health and her coping from what happened
to her
childhood.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she had cancer when she was 17, and then she when she had the second baby, when she had the second child, she got sick again. And there mm-hmm. were several medical things going on all at once. And I stayed with her. I was there for the second birth and stayed with her for 4 months. And then I called it the perfect storm, sarcastically, but my husband and I were living in Michigan, but I was staying in Oregon with my daughter. And my husband called and says, I'm moving. I got a new job in Silicon Valley. He's a physicist. So that's where those guys want to be, is Silicon Valley. So he got a job there. So I had to leave temporarily to go help move our home and get the house ready to rent. And so we moved everything to California. And while there, my daughter totally became unable to care for the kids. And before I could drive there, the kids were taken by DHS.
So this is,
and so then I've learned.
So the real issue is, in your story is about, children are often used as pawns, and they're sent back and forth between different family members and non-family members, and sometimes they're taken away from the family and they're put in, you know, a temporary foster system, and then the family has to fight to get them back, and sometimes, you know, they're not with blood relatives and so forth, and these issues are the kinds of issues that you've been fighting over, and I know the case continues, and you're having coming up in a couple of weeks, an appearance.
I don't. No, I'm in Oregon, grandparents aren't a party to the case. I mean, these children, Cash was 7 months old and Adia was barely two, and they've been with strangers for the last 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, you know, this is very critical time in infancy. I mean, there's a lot of arrested development things and problems that can go wrong with kids that are separated from their families during this time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my granddaughter cries, Nana, please take me home. And sometimes it's not all tears. But, you know, the bigger issue is there is no legal way right now for me to get into court to even ask for them. They have policies that stop families. You know, we don't all live in Oregon, but the state will not even entertain anyone that lives outside of Oregon to take care of these children.
And that's one of the issues, is that some of these laws and rules are different state to state and, of course, country to country. So you have to deal with whatever jurisdiction you're in. Deborah, I'll throw it back to you. I know you want to get some comments from some of the other panelists here, and I'll let you tell me which one you'd like to hear from next.
Well, because Aaliyah is a registered nurse, I would really like her to address the impact on these children being placed with strangers versus family members, because I think that is so important, that when there are healthy options with family members, why are they put with unknown strangers?
How shocking is that for Aaliyah? Yeah, of course.
Well, it reminds me of, first, I want to say you don't need common, you don't need to be a registered nurse to understand the dynamics of ripping children from their family, maternal family or paternal family, if they're available, opposed to putting them with strangers. So I didn't need a nursing degree to understand that. And actually, I did see that you guys had posted my first book. I was my mom. I wasn't raised with my mother or father. I was raised by my grandmother, my maternal grandmother. So, and mm-hmm. I had a wonderful and an amazing life. And I felt safe. And the only time I ever felt nervous was when strangers came and they made us say, well, if you do something wrong, we're going to put you in foster care. We're going to have mama, we call my grandmother mama, put you in foster care. That was the only time I
okay.
felt terrorized, because we knew, I'm almost 40 years old soon, and we knew what could happen in foster care. And then moving right along, a lot of us, I heard you open the show and you said you don't want to take sides, but if you really research, which is like that, are researching this topic now, and this is all rigged, it's all orchestrated, you get financial incentives to force adoption and put children in care. If CPS don't have children, don't have jobs. It's a business. It follows along the lines of the rules of slavery. It follows along the lines of the rules of how America came in and took the land and the heritage from the native children, and it follows along the lines of the Holocaust, and people have to start really addressing the rig, as I call it, and addressing the structure that is behind this. You can choose sides because it's orchestrated.
Okay, but NASCA can't. Our organization can't, because we're here to support, you know, all the causes and issues that come through the door. And if we choose one or two and latch onto it, then we could damage our ability to stay, you know, neutral and really present the issues. Deborah, I know you understand this, and we're going to spend some more time with Alea later in the show and talk about her particular story. But I wanted to, you know, get this first part of the show going and out and behind us. You also wanted Kevin, I believe, to comment, didn't you?
I really did. Kevin is really well-versed in the issues of targeting and intergenerational and, you know, the things that make people and foster care issues. He's very, very in tune with the issues that these people are facing on both sides, the parents and the children.
All right. So let's open up for Kevin Klein's comments about what he's heard so far. Kevin, of course, is the founder and director of, as I was told, Child Welfare Reform and Support Association in Tacoma, Washington. That certainly that's a pretty big title, Kevin. Wow.
Yeah, I've actually had people, try and get me to change it, and that might still happen in the future. But it's kind of something that I stuck with, and wanted to cover both the bases of child welfare reform as well as being able to support families that are involved in the system. So.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely a laborious process, and so I do it in my spare time, and I'm actually in the process of getting funding from private sources, so that way we have some money to work with, and I can devote at least part-time hours, maybe full-time hours to doing that instead of just kind of my spare time, which is not a lot. So it sounds like most of us are kind of, you know, volunteers doing this, but I might have a good opportunity here. So, I did have a few comments. One is that since that the Supreme Court case Troxell versus Granville, which I think was decided in it started in Washington State actually and went all the way to the Supreme Court, it actually did away with what grandparents' rights were in any of the 50 states that we have here. And since that time, I've been hearing stories from all across the country where grandparents have not been able to be party to any cases whatsoever. And the only time that they are able to be a party is if the department is looking to place the child with the grandparent. But of course, until they decide to do that, the grandparents are kind of left on the sidelines. And I've had some personal experience with that in my case, the cases that I've had personally, where a grandparent wasn't included during the process at all, so they're kind of stuck not having any information on what's going on, and oftentimes there is a very strong bond between the grandchild and the grandparents. And obviously that would be, you know, until things get figured out, you know, regardless of who's right, whether the state or the parents are right, the better situation is always to try and place that child with grandparents or other family if they're available. But oftentimes, you know, the state doesn't make a good effort, and there really is no laws that force them to. They're just supposed to make a good faith effort to try and contact all family. But of course, when you talk to a lot of parents and other people that are involved in the system, you always find that they wouldn't have to do much work to say find the dad or find a sister or an uncle or aunt or whatever. And they do actually have financial incentive not to put a lot of effort into contacting family, because if the child is placed with a relative, which is called a relative placement, the department ends up getting less money per child. And it's just like a school district, you know, where you know, their funding comes per child. And it creates a nasty situation where they're making decisions based off of money, whether it's, you know, decisions on placing the child or decisions on covering their own butts and trying to protect themselves from liability. So that's kind of the bit of information that I wanted to kind of get from my perspective.
That's really good. And we're going to come back to you throughout the show and get you know, input from you. But basically, you know, it also depends on where you are, how good or not so good. And it depends on different in each state and it's different in each province and stuff. Let me get Thomas Stone from Alberta to comment, if he wishes to, on what he's hearing so far. Thomas, you're on the air with us.
I guess I can't really comment on a lot of the details of this because I've been dealing with, I guess, subject matter that I've never really had to deal with, so I can't really give a formed opinion on much of this. As far as, I guess, giving children to grandparents and their involvement, I would have to say that should be based on the conduct of the grandparents, if they've been proven that they are able to support the child. But again, I also agree that every situation is different. So to me, like I say, I don't really feel like I know enough about this to give a well-rounded opinion on it.
Well, I appreciate that honesty, Thomas, to be frank. You know, a lot of kids are brought up in our society by their grandparents, even just in a normal way. And this is true in a lot of the inner city groups for sure. Here in Los Angeles, there's a lot of single-parent families that eventually, it's usually the mom, eventually the mom has to go back to school or get a job. And, of course, pretty much the grandparent, and they even live together, is the one who spends most of the time with the children. So this is not an unusual phenomenon by any means. But in the end, Deborah, the bottom line ought to be what's best for the children, and it has to be on an individual case. Like Thomas said, there are bad grandparents too, you know, so you can't just make a blanket statement.
Oh, definitely. In my case, it's an issue with the grandparents, yet I will still fight for good grandparents' rights wholeheartedly. I mean, that's why I said there's not good and bad people of every group, but there's good and bad situations. There are good and bad people, but that's the point. They're good and bad. And Aaliyah made an excellent, excellent point, is that she herself grew up with her grandmother, so she had a cultural connection, a blood connection. She had safety, security, connection to the rest of her family, a good upbringing. And I think what she meant is not so much taking sides. I sort of understood it a little bit more as to say that the system is behaving wrong, and I agree with that. I think the system is wrong. I agree with her on that, and I agree with her and Kevin combined on the reason it's wrong is because as long as children are commodities, then there will be abuse, because that is just the way it works for any situation that there are commodities and money involved with no accountability, and the only incentive is to make more money from the commodities. And if Aaliyah could address the difference of being raised by a grandparent versus you know, how it kept her connected to her family and culture, I think that would be really great.
Okay, and I want to come back after Aaliyah's comment here, which you've asked her to give. Tracy hasn't had a chance to comment either. So go ahead, Aaliyah, and then we'll get Tracy's comment.
Actually, I never felt out of place. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello.
Can now.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes.
Being raised by, I never felt out of place until I started getting older and realizing that my mother was supposed to be there, like around, you know, like the age of maybe like 11 and 12, you know. But like I said, I never went without anything, and it was, I was always in fear that I met foster kids growing up, and that
mm-hmm.
was my only fear, that I would mm-hmm. be in a foster care system. And
right.
from over almost like 30-something years ago, it was always considered a horrible system to be a part of. And my aunt was the director of ACS, which was BCW, Bureau of Child Welfare, before they changed their name to ACS after so many horrible deaths and violations and human crisis.
And what does that stand for?
Now they changed their name to Administration for Children's Services. But
okay.
before, when my aunt was the director, she was the Bureau of Child Welfare. So
okay.
I'm familiar with the system. I'm familiar with the atrocities that took place, and I was just always so glad and so happy that I wasn't there, and to know that, like, I meet, now I'm working with, you know, I'm the founder of Heal Network, www.healnetinc.org, and working with thousands of mothers and other organizations where children can be placed with relatives, and the system is intentionally blocking it due to their financial
mm-hmm.
incentives. It is really
And we're going to come to you in just a couple of minutes now, and get and you're kind of the second part of our show tonight, and we're going to ask you for, in more detail, to explain what it is you do and so forth. So don't fret, we'll be back to you. But I did, Deborah, we skipped over Tracy, and I don't want her to feel like she's not important. She is. And I want to give her a chance to comment on this round with everybody else. So, Tracy, if you'd like to make a comment, please feel free to do so.
Hi, Bill. Thank you. I think what I mean, I'm in Canada here, and I'm on Twitter, and I hear a lot of stories from people in the U.S. and the U.K. a lot, and it really, really seems there is a lot of tragedy where it just seems there's not good faith attempted for reunification with the family or to put supports in the family. And I know this forced adoption thing, it just seems so horrendous. So for me, I would just like to see more good faith effort really in family, keeping families together, supports,
yeah.
and attempts at that for the benefit of the child, because you think of the trauma that they suffer. And then we see that in our jail system and our psych wards and all the trauma these children have experienced. Yeah,
exactly.
And I worked in corrections, so I've heard a lot of background from people and,
mm-hmm.
and everything. So, yeah, that's what I'd like to say. So I'll pass it on to somebody else. Thanks.
Very good. You know, so bottom line is all these things should be about the welfare of the children, but you can't make a blanket statement that one set of relatives or one set of organizations or another, you know, is the best situation. It really has to be an individual, you know, each case one at a time figured out. And unfortunately, Deborah, there are, how many children are involved here in the U.S. and Canada? Hundreds of thousands, anyway. And in the wealth in the foster systems, and we do believe that the foster systems have a lot that's broken for them in them, and they really need to be redone. But we're talking about the welfare of an awful lot of kids. All right.
I did want Jane to address something for us.
Yes.
She went to some absolutely extraordinary lengths to get her
mm-hmm.
grandchildren back. And I would actually, because we are talking about good and bad grandparents, and then there are family members that go so far above and beyond. That's how
uh-huh.
she ended up writing a book and having it published about, you know, and I would like her to let people know just the length she went to, because to me this is where the system fails so terribly, because no foster parent would go to the lengths this woman went to get her grandchildren. And if she could elaborate on that, I would really,
sure.
really appreciate that.
All right, and as they come to her, I want Carol to know I see her there, and we'll include her on the next round once she hears these comments. But, Jane, you're back on.
Okay, thank you. No, just to address what he said, I don't have any kind of issues in my background. I have no felonies, anything like that. I've offered to be drug tested randomly, fingerprinted randomly. The other thing, too, is the story changes. The bar gets higher every time. First, there was a reunification plan with my daughter. Then her illness became so extreme that they waived that off and decided, oh, okay, well, you can go to foster training classes, which are 8 or 9 classes that you have to attend once a week. So here goes 9 more weeks of my life and the children, you know, the carrot at the end, if you would. And so when I'm about 5 or 6 weeks through this class, one of the caseworkers meets with me and says, oh, you know, we've decided you shouldn't even fill out the application because since you live in, you know, the State Families Act says that you and your husband can't live in 2 states because I was moving away from my husband. I mean, we weren't divorcing, but, you know, I'm trying to help my family, trying to keep my family together. And I offered to get an apartment, to put video cameras in every apartment. Again, my husband's a fiber optic specialist, so he was going to wire it up for him. The state wasn't going to have to put any expense. You know, we could put cameras in every room so that they could see that I'm not harming the children in any way. And they said no. And this was not, you know, the state was going to say, we were going to put them on my husband's insurance. You know, we were going to save taxpayers. I mean, of course, I want my grandbabies, okay? I can't say that enough. But if you want to look at it from a monetary, you know, we were going to save thousands of dollars for the taxpayers, you know, by being able to put our children and our family our health insurance. And we can't do that. And most recently, because I've been active online, I get 1 hour once a month. And my last visit, they told me I could not bring my camera back because they saw pictures of my grandkids online. And if you go a step further, if they're concerned about the best interest of these children, when they are adopted in less than 2 months, unless I can get the legal fees together, then they are adopted and the state doesn't check on them again. Now, what we've learned is a lot of children, there was a research that just came out of L.A. about sex trafficking and rehousing. And these are children that go through and are adopted and literally go online and are basically what they're calling rehousing, but let's face it, they're sold. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these could be my grandchildren. And they're used in almost 60% children that are arrested in L.A. County come through the foster care system. Those are huge numbers, and I'm trying to keep my grandchildren from that statistic.
Mm-hmm. No, this is a horrible issue, and the statistics are incredible. And we certainly have sympathy for, you know, people that are fighting for their, you know, their rights and their kids. And we want you to know that Jane has a mission to save her kids. And we don't ask for funding, but what I'm going to do, Jane, is I'm going to give out your email address. And if people are interested in more information for you, it'll be easy then for them to find you. And by that way, you can certainly get support from anyone who's interested. Jane Wells, of course, and the email address is jane.wells, with a plural, and the number 420@gmail.com. jane.wells420@gmail.com. And we'll go back now to the panel. Deborah, this is it's really, you know, difficult and sad and I don't know what other adjectives to add on here, but you know, what a big problem we have here.
Definitely. There's 2 issues, actually, that really come up for the story with me as well, in addition to placement with family. And one is, again, Jane alluded to, is the cost-benefit analysis, because each of these cases, we're not actually looking at thousands. We're looking at tens of thousands of dollars, sometimes hundreds of thousands per case, because of all all the testing, all the hospitalization, all the medicating, all the addiction issues or mental health issues that develop from these torn apart families, the cost of raising these children in care. So the cost benefit analysis is one issue that I would like us to address further, and Kevin probably has a lot of insight on that. And we'll get to him for that maybe.
Sure. Kevin, comment on this issue?
If we're talking specifically about the funding, because I've been kind of writing down stuff as we've been going. Go over what you were saying one more time, Deborah, so that way I can kind of get a gist one more time of what you're talking about.
Basically, how much it would cost the state or the province, depending on where you are, literally no more than $1,000 maybe a month for some families to make all the difference in the world for home supports or something like that.
Yes.
Versus
yes.
the tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars cost to the families and communities of ripping even one family apart through the collateral damage.
That's something that I've always argued when we start looking at state budgets and that kind of stuff, and we're talking about cutting funding for say like TANF programs and food stamps and that kind of stuff. Most child welfare cases involve poverty as an underlying issue, and here we are talking about tens of thousands of dollars for these cases that the state ends up getting and distributing to both their own entity as well as the different vendors that they use, nonprofits. Some of these nonprofits are making millions upon millions of dollars, per year off these contracts, and they have no incentive whatsoever to argue for any type of effective change in the system. But you are right; it is a lot of money, we set a bad precedent, many many years ago when we passed CAPTA, and it essentially started each child welfare department in each state because the way that they set it up, the states were told that for them to get the money, they had to set up these different departments. And of course, over the years, CAPTA has been changed to increase funding for things like adoption incentives, increase funding for hiring more child welfare workers and stuff. But what hasn't kept pace is the family preservation dollars, and those are the dollars that get used to take care of a power bill or take care of a situation where the family's homeless and living in their car. And things like that. And like I said earlier, when it comes down to placing, children with relatives like grandparents, there's less money involved in that. And so they have an incentive to not put a lot of effort. I was just going to say, from the earlier conversation, it really isn't state by state. It is case by case because there are workers out there. There are some who really believe that if the family is available that they will move mountains to try and make sure that the kid gets placed with the grandparent. But you have to be lucky and get that one worker that's really going to work with you like that. Just like you have to get lucky and get that public defender who's really going to go to bat for you. And so it's not, unfortunately, it isn't like every state has strong laws to protect, the family and try to keep the child child within the family. Unfortunately, there isn't laws like that. There are laws to protect the department and the things that it does, but there are not laws to protect the family itself. So when we hear things like, best interests of the child and that kind of stuff, I get really frustrated because, one, the question is who gets to decide the best interests of the child, and we can start talking about the people who get to decide that for these families. And the class of people who end up being involved in child welfare, whether it's the workers, whether it's the foster parents, whether it's, the judges and the attorneys and the different vendors and stuff like that. We don't talk about what's the best interest of the family, which includes not just the parents. Okay, go ahead.
Well, we need to keep moving on. So we're going to cover some of these other topics later. But I just want to make sure that everybody feels included. And there is one person, Kevin, who hasn't gotten a chance to say anything. And she's the co-host for the show normally. She got here a little late.
Fair enough. Yes, please. Yeah.
So let me just get her give her an opportunity to comment now that she's heard some of what we talk about. But Carol, this is an important topic. Please just comment on the reason that we devote you know, a show every 2 weeks to this topic, and we're glad to do it.
Well, we do this every 2 weeks, Bill, to bring forth information to the public, you know, about the system and how it's terribly flawed.
Right.
I was 20-some-odd minutes late. I just got in. I had issues that I had to take care of. So I don't really know what's going on here, but I can.
Right.
I did overhear something about putting cameras in rooms to show that there was no abuse going on. And I know how the system can fail the people. Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I need to hear more.
Okay, we all do. And we're about to switch gears a little bit now. It's up to Deborah when we want to do that, but I think we're pretty close to being ready. Deborah, do you agree?
I do, although I think Aaliyah could also give some really good, just before we finish up this economic issue, because I really think this is very important.
Okay.
Could Aaliyah weigh in on that as well? Thank you.
Here she comes. Go ahead, Aaliyah.
Hi, we were talking about the financial impact that the taxpayers pay, and I know in New York City, the lawyers that had been assigned as child lawyers to cases, they were billing as much as $75,000 per child, when in most of the cases they never even saw the child. And one lawyer, Susan Chanelas, took her, the lawyer that was receiving numerous of cases, and she was charged $75,000 per case, and she had not even seen the child. And then in another case, the child only 10 times, and child, there were like 10-minute visits, 15-minute visits, because the child would not open up to her. And the therapist that they attached, these experts, some of these experts couldn't get a job. We in New York City, because I'm from New York, and I know a lot of the New York cases, some of the therapists that they chose as experts couldn't be an expert anywhere on the planet Earth, only in family court. And they were charging $45,000 per case and up, and they weren't even seeing the children. And so you had, like, the judges are steering these cases. These two particular lawyer and expert therapists that received the one in her practice, and even in my case, my therapist, if you go and rate him, anywhere you look on the internet, not only is he an AFCC member known for rigging custody cases, known very embedded in the family court and CPS system, he is everything that's said about him is horrible. His license has been under investigation, and they're charging taxpayers, in my case, I know well, into like $500,000 in a couple of years with the salaries we included, with the lawsuit that I brought against everyone, and it's like totaled almost $500,000. But I was saying that judges steer these cases to these experts that are incompetent, and they give them 20 and 30 and 50 cases, and then we notice that behind the scenes they support their election campaigns. They are part of, like, the same membership organizations like the AFCC, which is known for rigging custody cases and also known for being a pedophile abuser-friendly organization and jeopardizing children in the care of CPS and family court. So you say the system is broken, but it's actually fixed this way. It's a transference of wealth.
These therapists,
in the news, I can send you some news stories also where these therapists, if they were in practice normally, they would have made like $20,000 a year. But as soon as they were able to jump on a family court bandwagon and most of the time rig and stall and hinder custody cases, whether it's between the mother and the father or the state, like in Justina's case, where the state was fighting for their fighting parents for their child, we noticed that they had these experts that were making $200,000 and more, but they couldn't get a client anywhere else. But in family court, if you research, a lot of these experts are incompetent. And they're like the bottom feeders. And even the caseworkers that are hired for CPS, they have criminal records, been convicted of sex offenses. And, like, since my child, it's no secret, was captured in this custody catastrophe in 2012, I've been researching this family court and this catastrophe, and I'm just falling more and more and more down a rabbit hole, because you notice the rig is part of a bigger rig. You know, Divorce Corp had their story. It's different strategies for different families, but it all boils down to, whether you want to believe it or not, white supremacy, transferring of wealth. These are extraction institutions. You know, you can go in as two good parents that just want to amicably divorce, and it's called custody war. In war, you're going to lose your home, you're going to lose your happiness, your liberties, your justice, your freedom, your children. and the people that is initiating the war, the judges, the lawyers, the Legion of Doom, the experts, you know, everyone you think when you go into this court you can trust. So when you're thinking of custody and going into a family court, just think of anti-family, because these courts are not for us. Ironic, I can give you the telephone number of a mother. The judge goes to the grandparent's house. The father died in the custody battle, and now the judge is trying to give custody to the grandparents, and she hangs out with the grandparents. So, you know, it's just a really irate and crazy industry, and these are people, unfortunately, I'm dealing with thousands of mothers, organizations, and we're all seeing the same thing. It's same patterns, and it all boils down to transferring of wealth. And
well, that's a good way to put to describe it as an industry, Deborah. Because, and unfortunately, the commodity is children. You know,
I just had a question for Aaliyah, because I know that I think that AFCC, that was a big investigation recently by the IRS, wasn't it, Aaliyah? And that was like the nonprofit.
Well, what it is, it's a sham organization. It's a shady sham organization.
It's all owned by judges, right, isn't it? Like nonprofit or some sort of.
Yeah, but it's geared towards custody rigging. It's like they teach the handbook and the training how to rig custody cases, how to. Their history is always shady. They had that therapist come up with that post-alienation
mm-hmm.
syndrome,
mm-hmm.
Wagner. And what they're doing is, like I said, writing the rules for how to rig custody cases. And no judge, and it's so crazy because just 2 weeks ago I found out that the lawyer for the Children's Law Center in New York is an AFCC member, which I didn't know at the time when they were rigging my custody case. And I just found out that the executive director of the Children's Law Center is also an AFCC member, which I did not know at the time they were rigging my custody case, even though from day one I always called it a rig. However, the AFCC has always had a shoddy history. If you Google rigging of custody cases, besides my name coming up, you'll see other organizations, and they give the history of their arrests. It's been a lot of rigging from, they started about 1985, the federal, different chapters all over the country and now all over the world. You get it? So you got to be careful because this is all fixed. So what they do is they train how to basically steal money from the government. Those are the biggest payers, unless you're like a millionaire and they can make like a bunch of money, like off of like a case like Kelly Rutherford. They could take about $2 million from her, or Halle Berry, keep you in court. You know, it's a systemic system, like how you go to school and they teach you math and they teach you 1 + 1 = 2. Well, the AFCC, they tend, because they have so many front organizations. Like, it'd be like the Children's Law Center. However, they're using the justice system to rip children from their parents, to split the children in half, like in King Solomon, and to keep the wars stirring. Like, they know how to ignite the fire on these custody battles for profit, and that's all it's for. They don't care about the safety of your children. It's no longer the best interest of the child. It's now the best interest of the abuser and pedophile, which I call it POS because of that post-alienation syndrome, pedophile abuser sociopath supporter group. It's numerous articles. Ann Stevenson just wrote, she's a really awesome, incredible journalist that has had the courage to tackle these type of atrocities that's happening in family court. She recently wrote the piece on the AFC being busted in New York City. Like I tell you, they're everywhere. They have a chapter in every state all over the country. However, New York, why would judges and lawyers and therapists, oh, and the therapist they referred me to was an AFCC member as well.
Yeah, so they pretty much permeate the whole system there. We need to get some comments from other people, and I'm not sure. Let's see. Maybe Angela would be next. I think Angela's been a while. Angela, you want to make a comment about what you've heard so far?
Yeah, actually, I wanted to make a bit of a comment about Oregon itself.
Sure.
One of the issues that I think the reason why Jane is having problems is because a few years back here in Oregon, we had a child in foster care that they sent to relatives out of the state, and she ended up murdered. And so they passed a bunch of bills making it almost impossible for parents out of state, relatives out of state, to get children, you know, from the foster care in Oregon. I really, if you are an Oregon family, then, you know, you have a better chance. But only, like I said before, if you become foster parents, you know, like Kevin has said, they do want to try to keep that money. So, you know, they're going to go ahead and say, hey, we'll let you have a kid as long as you become foster parents so we can still get this, you know, money for it. But, I mean, really, this little girl, you know, she was sent out of state, and in a very short time, both Child Protective Service had kind of let her fall through the cracks. And, like I said, in a short time, she ended up murdered by her other relatives in Mexico. So, yeah.
So maybe some of these reactions in Oregon was in response to, you know, the severity of that case that was popularized up there. Let's get a comment from, let's see, who's next? Thomas, you haven't spoken in a while. You want to make a comment?
I have a few things to say on what I've heard so far. First of all, when you're dealing with the justice system period, as I've heard on here, I would agree, you're not talking about a system that is impartial. It is entirely rigged. That's pretty much, I think, a well-known fact. When you're, and I mean, I feel sorry for you, Jane. I mean, I can see that you were saying that you put up cameras in your place to show that these kids were not being mistreated in any way. The reality is, the justice system is not interested in you proving your case or proving your point. They're interested in poking holes in your case because they don't. They actually are there to make your life more miserable. They are not there to help you. This has been a headache that I have had to learn the hard way myself. I have a few friends of mine that I've had to go through the criminal side of the justice system, and what I've learned is that the entire system is just one big conspiracy and one big game on their part. You can show them in spades all you want that you are cooperating, and they will not be interested in hearing you out. Unfortunately, it's called the American injustice system for a reason, because it is not a justice system. It is an injustice system. That's just the reality that we have to deal with.
Okay. Let's get a comment from Carol, and then we'll go back to Deborah and see where we're going to go. Carol, a comment now that you've heard some of this show?
Oh, yeah. No, I totally agree. It's all about money. It's all about power and also the horrific abuse of children because they put them in harm's way. Obviously, this little girl was murdered. I had a situation where I got so mad at in New York with certain people I'm not going to mention on air that I said that I was going to write an article to the New York Times, and I was going to expose everything. And guess what? I won. That's the way you have to do it. You have to go ahead. You have to expose. You have to, you know, bring it forth where other people, you know, are going to learn, okay? They're going to learn what's really going on. I believe in the power of the pen. So
we have a panel of people here who are not afraid to be vocal, certainly maybe not verbal, writing-wise, but certainly vocalizing their thoughts. Deborah, going back to you. See where you'd like to take the show next.
I actually wanted to discuss the level of what actually everybody has has mentioned strongly is that it becomes an actually impossible task. You are forever being forced to prove a negative. They first of all there's a common theme running through Jane's case too, and these people were targeted for a disability. As many people are familiar with my case, I was targeted for a disability. I was told I must be an addict, so I passed hair test after hair test, ones that went back to before they took my child. Then I'm erratic because I won't take pain medication I don't need. Then I must be mentally ill because I'm upset they took my child, so I had 3 intensive psychiatric reviews that all say I'm fine. Then I must be too disabled to care for her. Well, 3 separate medical hospitals and another doctor, so you are forever running on a hamster wheel when the reality is that they keep telling you over and over, okay, well, things may have changed even in the last 2 weeks. Start all over again. There's no time limit, and there really is no way to prove a negative over and over forever. So to have to go to the lengths of I'll put cameras in every room of my home, that is a level of insanity that our society has reached in our desperation to keep our own children in our home, that we will be monitored like prisoners in a jail. And to me, that's an atrocity as well.
Sure. All right, and who would you like to go to next?
I actually would like to talk to Kevin as well about people are far more targeted when they have low income or disability issues, because that has been almost a common theme for every case we see, is that if you have any type of social hindrance, that makes you an immediate target of the system because you cannot fight back.
It's kind of an undesirable, I guess. Kevin, you comment on that?
Sure. I just real quick wanted to mention, because I heard it mentioned a couple times about having cameras in by like interview rooms and when you're working with social workers and that kind of stuff. And there was actually a bill in California that was that was sponsored. It didn't get a lot of co-sponsors, but it did get a hearing. And it did fail. It didn't make it out of the committee there in the California legislature. But it essentially would have required funding cameras that each of the social workers and investigators would have to wear, kind of like police officers. You know, and the argument was that well, if police officers can make mistakes despite their best efforts, and are required to wear cameras to protect themselves as well as the people that they deal with, why can't we have the same for social workers and investigators as well? And, of course, during that hearing process, and I had a chance to watch the full thing online from my house in Washington, but the whole process, they ended up having a caseworker after caseworker, investigator after investigator, social worker lobby after social worker lobby, and even nonprofits that were coming through and saying that this was a bad idea, that we didn't need it, it was going to cost a lot of money, yada yada yada, and of course it ended up failing. But it was interesting how like it got proposed, and then they immediately went in panic mode and did everything that they could to make sure that it didn't make it out of committee to have a full vote of the whole legislature there in California, because they knew that the chances were at least somewhat likely that if they made it out of committee, they would actually have a situation where it would have passed, and then they would have had to wear these cameras and that kind of thing. So I just wanted to add that real quick, just as a side note. But it is very true. Something like 98% of all child welfare cases involve either a low income family, usually single parent households, parents with disabilities, and even children with disabilities. Sometimes when a child has a disability, the department will, especially if a parent is a single parent and that kind of stuff, they will automatically make the assumption that child is at risk. And of course, with the way neglect laws are written in each state, it makes it very easy for the department to say that the child could be neglected, and that's the way that the laws are written. They do not have to prove that neglect has actually happened. They do not have to prove a pattern has been established. They just have to show that something could happen. So you end up having this situation where I don't know if you guys have ever seen that movie, The Minority Report with Tom Cruise. It was all based off of like pre-crime. So they had this system set up where they could actually, predict crimes before they happen and go in and arrest people before they actually committed the crime. And that's the way that neglect statutes are written. And so the department operates off of that. They operate off of the premise that if you're poor, if you're a single parent household, or even if it's a grandparent raising a child, they automatically assume that the grandparent is older, is probably got some frailties, that kind of stuff, and they automatically set to work trying to essentially destroy them. And that's just the way that the system is set up. I heard somebody make a comment earlier that the system isn't necessarily broken. It's been broken from the day that it got started, and it is true that oftentimes public policy can be done in such a bad way that you're kind of screwed from the get go, especially when you're talking about disadvantaged and disenfranchised groups of people in society, and especially when you're looking at it from a family standpoint. It's you and your family and your little bit of resources against a department that has the Attorney General's office behind it, large amounts of money and budgets behind it, and you have a society that has been trained to believe that if your child welfare involved, that you must have done something bad, and you deserve everything that comes your direction. And if your child ends up in the system, of course, there's always going to be somebody available to adopt that child. And that's just the way that it is. And it's really frustrating, but, like a lot of folks, that call into the show and stuff, we don't have any other choice but to devote the rest of our lives, however long we live, to fighting back the best that we can, and that involves organizing people and working to change the laws one by one, so that way the system does change. But we also need to be supporting families while they're involved in the system, and that can mean everything from helping out with power bills and keeping a roof over their heads to making sure they can get to their appointments and stuff, because all it takes is one missed appointment, and next thing you know, your case is blown out of the water. So I'm done.
Okay. And I'd also, of course, on that same theme, before we leave it, mention that, if you're really concerned about the welfare of kids and you have a little room in your life, consider being a foster parent yourself, because for all these tragic cases out here, there are a lot of kids who don't have anybody fighting for them. And, they really can use a stable home. So, that is one way. I'm an adopted child, and it was a successful adoption in my case and in my sister's. We were both adopted. And so it's not, it's not always a horror show, but it's made better by people who are quality people stepping forward and volunteering to take kids. So I just put that out there too, Deborah. of course.
No, definitely, Bill. And the irony of it is, because most people that care about children, a lot of people who want to become foster families start out because they care about children, and the system burns them out, and it can make all the difference. But if they were instead giving supports, like Kevin says, to the families and keeping them together, there would be such a reduced rate by almost 90% for foster homes that you could actually pick and choose like a Fortune 500, the best of the best, because you wouldn't need that many. There wouldn't be a desperate need for anyone who will take a child, especially if a child's already traumatized, so now they're labeled a problem child or they're Medicaid, and people get more money to take these problem children. So then you have to wonder, is it because they care about their problems or because they get more money and they don't recognize the problems are from trauma? So if we were giving supports to the families instead, we would actually not have a crisis of good foster homes. We would have an abundance of good foster homes.
Okay. I don't know if I agree with that, but I guess so. I mean, I can see what you're saying. You know, the more families that stay together, the less kids there are that are in crisis. I get that. And so, you don't need as many foster parents. But right now, there's a problem with there aren't enough quality foster parents, I know, in most places. So the kids end up being institutionalized, and that's a pretty horrible situation for a lot of kids. Anyway, where would you like to go next, Deborah?
I would like to just pop it over to Leah if she wants to make a comment on that before we close that subject on targeting.
You bet. Where'd she go? Leah. She might have dropped off. Let me see. Yes, she did. She dropped off. Hopefully she'll call back in. But as of right now, she's not with us. So we have to pick somebody else for the moment.
Oh, okay. She has dropped off, but we were going to mention that she's actually currently working on a documentary called The Rig, and it does, if anybody is interested in looking into that, it does cover a lot of the issues going on in the family court systems, and it just goes into in-depth with that. So we'll just mention that since she seems to have lost the connection here. And then I wanted to discuss a little bit more of the targeting. We discussed disability, we discussed low income, but there's another very important thing that sort of ties into the theme of keeping children with family as well as targeting, is that the cultural and minority targeting, because it is so statistically skewed that we should be making twice as much effort to take children from other cultures that are forced to be in care, because we shouldn't be taking them in care just when they're in another culture, which puts them at more risk. But they also lose their culture and their identity because they make up the minority of the population but the majority of the foster care. So there should be even more effort put to place them with family members to at least keep them in touch with their heritage and culture, which now I'm going to throw that one over to Kevin as well.
Okay. Kevin, a comment on that?
I'm sorry. Hold on one second here. Let me take you off the speakerphone. Oh, no. I'm sorry.
That's okay. We can hear you.
Okay.
Yeah, we hear you fine. Okay.
I'm actually off the speakerphone. I didn't hear, like, the last, like, minute or so because I was trying to get stuff together. So.
Oh.
Yeah.
Maybe,
I wanted you to comment on the targeting by minorities and what it does to them when they're not placed with family members or other people of the same culture, race, or religion, like Aboriginal or basically
okay.
almost.
Yeah, okay. One of the things that I've noticed kind of in my day-to-day work and stuff is that, especially when you go to states with, like, high native populations like South Dakota, North Dakota, states like New Mexico and that kind of stuff. Even though the Indian Child Welfare Act states that the state must place that child with a native family if there's one available. Those particular states have a history and are actually in the process of being sued, especially in states like North Dakota, South Dakota. They're being sued for violating the act time again. And they end up placing these kids with white families that don't understand the culture and don't have the capability, no matter how much they try, to raise these kids to understand their culture and to be part of a native family. But then you also go to states like California, New York, and that kind of stuff, where you have something like sometimes as high as like 80% of the kids are being taken from homes where they're were there black families or Hispanic families and that kind of stuff. And you have a small pool of black and Hispanic foster homes available, and so these kids are being placed not only outside of their families, but they're not being placed with foster homes that represent their heritage and their backgrounds and that kind of stuff. But I think the bigger issue is that the departments in each state end up targeting and they'll admit it. They'll admit that they end up targeting children and families of color, whether they're black or Hispanic, and natives as well. But when they admit it, they find a way to excuse the situation, absolve themselves of responsibility, because they basically just say it's just the way that it is, and we don't have any answers to it. But we do have, like in our state here, just real quick, there are groups of people that, including child welfare workers, who set up these committees that talk about trying to find ways to acknowledge that the child welfare system is full of kids that are of color, but also try to find ways to stop doing that, I guess. Every time I look, not much is ever done with it. They set up these committees, and then everybody kind of forgets about it, and nothing ever gets done. And it's just a revolving process. There's not a lot of incentive to correct the situation because most of the kids, and of course the money's attached to these kids, most of these kids are from poor neighborhoods or from minority neighborhoods and that kind of stuff. And if they took that out of the equation, they'd have no money. And you have to have money to operate these systems, and especially when a large portion of their budget, sometimes as high as 75-80%, comes from the federal government, you can't, you have to do what your money allows you to do. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, lots of good points there.
Yep.
What part of the discussion would you like to go into next, Deborah, and who would you like to go to? She just came back, by the way. Angela Aaliyah just came back. I don't know if she heard us in the last segment or not.
If she did, would she like to make a comment on that?
Well, I'll have to see if she heard us. She's only been back for 20 seconds, so she might not have heard what Kevin just said. Aaliyah, she didn't hear that. She didn't hear the comment.
I lost service.
Sorry.
We'll come back to you, Aaliyah.
We were discussing the effects of targeting of children, of minority children, and what happens, the effect on them of ripping them away from their culture, and because they make up the vast majority of children in care, but the minority of the population, so there's no way they can be accommodated in the system and have their and still be connected to their culture in any way.
Right. Well, we know that black and brown children creates billions of dollars for the system. I actually wrote a letter on Polite Society back in May. The letter is still up there. It was an open letter to the mayor addressing the rig. As we know, these children are placed into the system, ripped from their heritage. And like I said, the savvy tricks that they have in CPS and family court, it runs a line with the Holocaust and slavery. They pretend. If you go to New York City, you have protesters out there that are begging the Child Protective Service agency to give their children back to them. But then they'll document that they have no placement. They're known for false documenting, fabricating evidence, everything to rig the system so these children won't be placed in proper, safe homes with devoted, loving people that care about them. This is the financial incentives that they receive. There's no oversight, so therefore billions of dollars go missing, and they litigate these families into the nut house until they finally give up and lose hope and say, I'll just wait till the child
turns 18 years old or until someone dies, like the children we know in New York when they change their name from one name to another, because when the children die, they don't want to be known attachment with that other system. But the system is fixed this way. It's not broken. It's fixed. The lawyers make millions of dollars for their agency. The judges get the kickbacks. The therapist that could have never gotten a job anywhere on the planet Earth gets become wealthy. And if you research it, if you just look and you can connect the dots, it ties into that Agenda 21 that they're actually have implemented since 1992 per the Bush administration. We call it the Illuminati, the conspiracy theory, but it's actually Agenda 21 taking place, where they create fancy, beautiful names like Safe Horizons, but no domestic violence victim is safe. They create all of these beautiful children's law center, but then they use lawyers to destroy families and heritage and connections. And they say the best interest of the child, when we all know that from experience and from research that this is not the best interest. You know, they say the judges need more education. No, common sense will tell you not to place a child with an abuser or a pedophile. And I wanted to report back, Oregon, if they changed those laws, they gave the father that was a sex abuser custody, and he took the daughter down to Mexico and raped her and killed her. They gave sole custody to the father. It wasn't like a grandparent or an outside family member. And the mother had begged to not take the child out of the state and not let the father get custody. And that was the Oregon case that, and they use these little scams and these little tricks to toughen up the laws, to keep the rig going. But if you really want to get to the bottom of it, it's all that extraction institution techniques to play pawns against each other and pull the money out into the system and make everybody else rich and everybody else poor. And that's what white supremacy is based off of also, you know.
Okay, you've made that point several times. I just want
to
leave time
so that
we can tell.
You said it on this show.
I'm sorry, Aleah, we only have a finite amount of time. You said that several times, and I still want to give you more time, but I want to speak specifically about the fact that you are an author, that you have three books. We have them listed in the description for tonight's show. One is called Beat, and it chronicles your life as an abandoned child growing up in the streets of Brooklyn. The second one is A Little Lynched, about a judge-ordered kidnapping. And then the third one is Please Tell My Mother I Love Her. But in addition to that, while you were away, we briefly mentioned that you're working on a documentary called The Rig, which features stories of judicial kidnapping, as described to me, and court license abuse. And you have a nonprofit, or I think it's a nonprofit. You're the founder and director of something called Heal Network Inc., which you mentioned briefly earlier. We only have 10 minutes in the show left, Aleah, so I want you to be able to touch on at least some of those things and talk about the activism that you're involved in as we finish up the show before we run out of time.
Okay, I was the founder of a 501c3 organization that helps children in the community for better opportunities of all races and colors before I was captured into the family court custody and had one of my children stolen. And I focused on the new book, A Little Lynch, because exactly how I felt when I was in this system, like it was like up. What was up meant down, and there was no truth. They were fabricating evidence to steal children. Now that I'm captured here, I'm very vocal, as you can tell, and I'm speaking to other mothers, and I'm attending their custody hearings now, and I'm going from state to state, from New York all the way from to California to North Carolina, because I'm seeing that the system is rigged. And so, yes, I do have a book coming out this year called The Rig, and we are doing a documentary of how I discovered, like, before I was captured in the cause of this system, I had an awesome and amazing life. I was running Hill Network, as I still am running the organization, and you can reach me, hillnetinc.org. You can research the organization. It is a 501c3, and I felt I was targeted because I was helping children. I had no idea about, you know, I thought relationships were getting better. I had that ponies and unicorn view, as some people say, that the world is becoming such a better place. Inside America, race relations are becoming, you know, so awesome, and I was avoiding the real issues that was going on around me. And actually, I do believe in God, and this was God's assignment for me. And God, please tell my mother I love her. Was I bumped into my son, who was stolen from me by family court, and I bumped into him on the street, and he was like, I tell God that I love you all the time. I tell God, please tell my mother that I love her. And it was like it struck a nerve, because I remember when I was younger and I didn't have my mother growing up, I always would, like, send messages through God. So, and that kept me going, and I kept the faith out, also surrounding, like, the amazing family that I had, so forth and so on. But, yeah, Aretha Lynch, you can get it on Amazon. It's a lot of true stories that people have posted there. And The Rig will be out this year. We started the documentary. We're continuing this at our Mother's Conference in October 10th through 12th, where we have the keynote speakers, Mildred Muhammad, the ex-wife of the D.C. sniper, who also had her children stolen by the family court system for 18 months. And so it's like a mother empowerment conference, so we ask the mothers from all over the country to come so we can really just try to defeat this machine. Like, people say, oh, we can't be defeated. Well, the Holocaust was defeated. Slavery was defeated. And they just come up with new ways of tricking us. But Mr. Murray, if you've been a part of the system, it's an atrocity. I have to stop answering my phone sometimes because the mothers are calling. Their children are being sex trafficked. Their children are being stolen. And just like from my personal experience, they were fabricating, like they were relentless in trying to steal my child. Like how they're relentless in preventing this good grandmother from getting her child, her grandchildren, they're relentless in how they organize and orchestrate anything to try and take your child away from you. And it's just not right.
If I could address that, Aaliyah, too, I would like to how relentless they have been with Jane is that they have now, despite all she has done, told her that they will give her 2 more 1-hour visits and then they will terminate her rights to even visit or see her grandchildren ever again and adopt them out without ever having given her a chance. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that she has written 2 books as well that cover her story in much more detail called Run, Jane, Run. And there's book 1 and then book 2, because as you know, she had a powerful backstory and now she's dealing with it in the present sense. But that is relentless as it gets, forced adoption and termination of family rights for absolutely no reason at all.
Yeah, Run, Jane, Run, A True Story of Murder and Courage. You can listen to the full story of Jane's, what's happened to Jane in 2 weeks ago's show. By the way, if you want to listen to any of the shows for our kids, all you do is you go to NASCA.org/ and type in for our kids, and it'll take you to the page that now lists the 6 episodes we've done so far, and it'll continue to add to it. And every time we add to the show, you can, you know, we're adding to kind of the library of information that we're offering. James' basic show was last time, but that's where you can find Run, Jane, Run information. But if you want to get in touch with her, as I said before, please do write to her at jane.wells420. jane.wells420@gmail.com. And I also want to make sure people understood that to get in touch with Aaliyah Holland, who is an RN and founder and director of Heal Network, Inc., you can go to HealNetInc.org, HealNetInc.org. That's the website that she's maintained. And, of course, I'm sure you can get information about the three novels, Beat, A Little Lynched, and Please Tell My Mother I Love Her, in addition to the upcoming A Rig, which is all these are about the experiences that she's had in the judicial system, and you'll find out the kinds of activities. And she sounds very active. And you can hook up with her and join her in this cause. And we're really glad that both those ladies have been with us tonight. Deborah, we have to wrap up to the show, so I'm going to give you a couple of minutes here for some final thoughts, if you'd like.
I'd like to send it to Angela because I know she hasn't had a lot to say, and she's actually been following Jane Wells' case very, very closely for a long time.
She's on.
Oh.
Angela, 4 minutes. We've got 4 minutes left in the show.
All right. Well, you know, I kind of have been following along with Jane, and I feel very concerned and very frustrated for her as well. You know, I can't understand why an incident that happened with someone else will affect everyone else's cases in the future. It's like a black and white thing. It for them, it becomes a, then all relatives shouldn't be a part of the family for fear that something could happen to the kid, instead of actually really reviewing each one of the cases. You know, and it's sad that's what Jane is now facing right now. It doesn't matter what she does or how much she does. Really, those grandkids,
right.
I mean,
all right.
I don't want to see.
Okay, so we only have a couple, 3 minutes left now. Deborah, final thought?
Yes, I actually wanted to also say that to contact Kevin Klein, go to all one word together, supportthepoorfamily.org. Now, he is very, very active. It is supportthepoorfamily.org. I wanted to make sure everybody could be contacted. Poor
family. So there's
two
T's in the middle there together, right? Support the poor family.
Yes.
All one word. Support the poor family. Yes. Great. We got that in, and I've made a note of that, so in the future we'll be able to say that too. I just want to thank everybody who was on the show, and it's quite a list. You know, when we have this many people, I know it's hard for some people to feel like they – there was enough time, and sometimes I just do the best I can when I'm going around to everybody. But we had, of course, Angela Bworfs. We had Deborah and Tracy from British Columbia. We had Thomas Stone from Alberta. We had Jane. We had Carol Levine. We had Kevin Klein. And we had Alea Holland from Brooklyn, New York. And, of course, I'm Bill Murray from Los Angeles. We definitely had an international crowd tonight, Deborah, and you can't complain about that. So,
the more voice, the better we.
And we'll be here you'll be here bringing a new story or two every 2 weeks on Thursday night. And of course, as I said before, if people are interested in reading more about the organization, or they can write to nasca.forourkids@gmail to get to you. They can also go though to nasca.org/forourkids. And that'll take them to the page that's devoted to this show, and all the information is there. This is Bill thanking everyone who was on the show tonight again and saying, please do join us 6 nights a week, every night except Saturday night. We're here for another version of Stop Child Abuse Now. The regular pattern for our shows is on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. We have special guests. We skip Saturday. On Sunday, we do our News of the Week show, which are shows anybody can call in on. And we provide all the materials. The topics of the news of the week are all the articles that have appeared on our two websites in the previous week. And so we provide all that information. And then on Tuesdays and Thursdays, like we did tonight, we have either open topic or planned topics. And, of course, every 2 weeks on Thursday, we have planned topics before our kids group brings them to us. And it's always something about the rights of children and families in North America. We're very grateful to Deborah Madison for wrangling this, and we appreciate your being here tonight, too. So join us tomorrow night, 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific, for another edition of Stop Child Abuse Now. May God bless you, God bless the children of the world, and God bless adult survivors of child abuse.
I'll know tomorrow, 'cause Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.